This is our sad reality, and we need to change the reality as a big picture. This is not about video games. This is not about mental health. That happens all around the planet. This is about guns and easy access to guns. Whoever defers that is wrong and is not understanding where the problem is.
And Manuel Oliver, we have only about 30 seconds, but I'm wondering, in terms of, were you able to affect, if not at the national level, at the state level in Florida after the Parkland shooting, some changes in gun policy?
We got changes in the opposite way. Now we have Ron DeSantis as the governor, who is planning to leave us before getting out of the office, an open carry law. So God bless us, unless we get rid of this guy, which I'm planning to do.
Well, Manuel Oliver, our love to Patricia, your wife. Manny is co-founder of the gun reform group Change the Ref, father of Joaquim, one of the 17 people killed in the 2018 mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Of course, we'll continue to follow the story, what's happening in Congress, what's happening in Texas, and what's happening around the world. Families have begun sharing the names of the victims, and we'll end with their names again, as we started. Xavier Lopez, 10. Jose Flores, 10. Uzziah Garcia, 9. Amory Jo Garza, 10. Annabelle Guadalupe Rodriguez, 10. And 2 fourth grade teachers. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Cam Baker, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlon, Juan Carlos Davila, our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hey, Michael here. I'm with the Tin Can Phone Podcast, a radio show where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the source. We tell you the story from the inside out, so make sure to check us out on KBOO Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 7th Annual Vanport Mosaic Festival, on now through Tuesday, June 7th in Portland. The Vanport Mosaic is back with its annual Memory Activism Festival to, quote, remember, repair, reclaim, and reimagine our collective story. The festival will center on the 80th anniversary of the building of Vanport, once Oregon's second largest city, and the largest World War II federal housing project in the United States. Highlights include Vanport the Musical and a panel discussion on Portland's past, present, and future of affordable housing. Again, that's the 7th Annual Vanport Mosaic Festival, on now through Tuesday, June 7th in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Stand by me.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Public Schools passes $1.9 billion budget. Massachusetts sues Exxon for lies on climate change. And, in international news, Ukraine calls for peace talks but sees no results. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 25th, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. Once plentiful and massive in Oregon's rivers, several species of salmon in the Northwest are on the path to extinction. Despite $2 billion in federal aid, salmon spawned in hatcheries to replace wild stock have survival rates far below sustainable levels. A report by Oregon Public Broadcasting and ProPublica showed that a federal program to maintain salmon populations for indigenous groups is failing largely due to its lack of solutions for problems facing salmon. Since the program began, the number of young salmon headed to the ocean each year tripled. Only a tiny fraction returned to spawn. Hatchery-bred salmon lack the genetic fitness of wild salmon, so fewer survive the return journey upriver. Dams on the Columbia River are a major factor in the decline of salmon populations, but federal studies show that warming waters from climate change could lead to survival rates declining by as much as 90% from their current levels, already dangerously below what is necessary for a sustainable population. Pollution, overfishing, and invasive species are exacerbating the problem. Tribal nations, such as the Nez Perce and the Yakima people, rely on salmon for food and consider them a staple and an inextricable part of their cultural heritage. Aaron Penny, a Nez Perce biologist and environmental resources veteran, says that remedying the problems facing salmon with hatcheries is like, quote, putting a finger in a dike to stop a leak, end quote. The nonprofit Earthworks released a new map this week which shows that more than 17 million Americans live within the health threat radius zones of oil and gas facilities. Oil and natural gas extraction can lead to health complications for those living nearby, including 4 million American children. With more, it's Roz Brown.
A newly created map reveals more Americans are being exposed to health threats from proximity to oil and gas production facilities. The map's release Tuesday comes ahead of new industry safeguards expected from the EPA. MAP co-creator Alan Sepdoff with the group Earthworks says more than 144,000 New Mexicans live within a threat radius of an oil and gas facility, defined as being a half mile. Sepdoff says since the group's first nationwide analysis in 2017, millions more people have been added to the threat radius map.
17.3 million people live within the threat radius, up 4.7 million from 5 years ago. Almost 4 million kids under 18 live within the threat radius. 3.2 million students go to school at 12,400 schools.
New safeguards being considered by the EPA would reduce greenhouse gas emissions and associated toxic air pollution from new and existing oil and gas facilities and address routine flaring. The gases from extraction are known to increase rates of cancer, asthma, and other diseases. Earthworks' Andrew Kloster is based in Colorado, a state with some of the strongest regulations in the country. Nonetheless, he says what's written on paper and what's happening on the ground do not align because the state doesn't have the capacity to enforce its regulations.
In all the states that we work, whether it's Colorado or Texas, sites are not being inspected frequently enough and regulations are not being enforced as forcefully as they should be.
Despite a new reporting program implemented by the New Mexico Oil Conservation Division, quarterly reports show 262 operators did not file information about how much natural gas was lost to venting and flaring. Kloster says that's why new oil and gas development is making the problem worse.
The industry, by and large, is still policing itself when it comes to air quality violations. And there's a presumption on the part of regulators that they're voluntarily complying with most of the rules that have been adopted. The result of this presumption is pollution that continues to harm communities in all of the states that we work.
This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Massachusetts Supreme Court ruled today in favor of a government lawsuit against ExxonMobil for spreading misinformation about global warming. The ruling is the latest legal blow to the fossil fuel industry, which for decades downplayed their central role in the climate catastrophe. The Massachusetts lawsuit invoked consumer protection laws, showing evidence that Exxon knew about the impact of fossil fuels on the environment, but lied about that impact to consumers as well as investors. Research linking global warming to human-caused emissions has been well known since the 1980s, including internal studies conducted by fossil fuel companies like Exxon. Exxon attempted to have the case thrown out as an infringement on free speech. Other cases around the country, from Rhode Island to Hawaii, are being allowed to proceed on similar grounds. A gunman killed 21 people, including 19 children, at a Texas elementary school yesterday. Democratic politicians decried the 27th school shooting of the year and publicly called for more gun safety laws. Law enforcement officers eventually broke into the classroom and killed the gunman. Police responding to yesterday's attack also went around breaking windows at the school to enable students and teachers to escape. All the victims were in the same fourth grade classroom at Robb Elementary in Uvalde, Texas. Investigators did not disclose a motive, but identified the assailant as Salvador Ramos, a resident of the community, which is about 85 miles west of San Antonio. They are working with the FBI and looking at social media to see if there were any red flags before the shooting. Ramos had allegedly hinted on social media that an attack could be coming, according to State Senator Roland Gutierrez. The gunman allegedly suggested the kid should watch out and that he had purchased two assault weapons after turning 18. Investigators also believe Ramos posted photos on Instagram showing the two guns he used in the shooting. The attack in the heavily Latino town was the deadliest shooting at a U.S. school since a gunman killed 20 children and 6 adults at Sandy Hook in Newton, Connecticut in December of 2012. On Wednesday morning, volunteers were seen arriving with Bibles and therapy dogs. National firearm reform seems unlikely, though. Repeated attempts over the years to expand background checks and enact other curbs on guns have run into Republican resistance in Congress. Before the attack, Ramos shot and wounded his grandmother, then left the scene, crashing his car at the school and making his way inside. The Texas Department of Public Safety said a tactical team forced its way into the classroom where he had barricaded himself. They were met with gunfire, but were apparently able to shoot and kill the suspect. Earlier reports said a Border Patrol agent, who was working nearby when the shooting began, entered the school without waiting for backup and shot and killed the gunman. Uvalde, home to about 16,000 people, is about 75 miles from the border with Mexico. Robb Elementary, which has nearly 600 students in second, third, and fourth grades, is in a mostly residential neighborhood. Texas has some of the most gun-friendly laws in the nation and has been the site of some of the deadliest shootings in the U.S. over the past 5 years. In 2018, a gunman killed 10 people at Santa Fe High School in the Houston area. Just before, a gunman killed more than 24 people during a Sunday service in the small town of Sutherland Springs. In 2019, a gunman at a Walmart in El Paso killed 23 people in a racist attack targeting Hispanics. The shooting came just days before the National Rifle Association annual convention is set to begin in Houston. Governor Greg Abbott and both of Texas U.S. senators are among elected GOP officials who are scheduled speakers at a Friday NRA-sponsored leadership forum. With more on the story, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
So tonight, I ask the nation to pray for them, give the parents and siblings the strength in the darkness they feel right now. As a nation, we have to ask, when in God's name are we going to stand up to the gun lobby?
President Joe Biden delivered remarks yesterday evening after a gunman killed at least 19 children and 2 adults at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas. Texas Governor Greg Abbott said the suspect entered the school with a handgun and may have had a rifle, although that has not been confirmed. Uvalde Police Chief Pete Arredondo spoke shortly after the shooting.
And at this point, the investigation is leading to tell us that the suspect did act alone during this heinous crime.
Abbott has confirmed the shooter, an 18-year-old male, is deceased. Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy spoke on the Senate floor to urge action from his fellow lawmakers.
What are we doing? There have been more mass shootings than days in the year. Our kids are living in fear every single time they set foot in a classroom because they think they're going to be next. What are we doing?
According to tracking by Education Week, the Uvalde school massacre marks the 27th school shooting this year. Several Texas lawmakers are scheduled to speak at a National Rifle Association conference in Houston on Friday, including Senators Ted Cruz and John Cornyn, along with former President Donald Trump. Biden is expected to issue an executive order today aimed at overhauling federal policing on the 2-year anniversary of the death of George Floyd. Georgia, Texas, Alabama, Arkansas, and Minnesota held primaries on Tuesday. Stacey Abrams won the Democratic nomination for governor in Georgia. She ran unopposed. She spoke to reporters on Election Day.
And I urge everyone to pay less attention to rhetoric and more attention to the record and to the results.
Former Senator David Perdue is expected to lose an attempt to win the state's GOP nomination from incumbent Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, dealing a blow to Trump, who had endorsed Perdue. The Associated Press reports Herschel Walker has won Georgia's Republican Senate primary and will face incumbent Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock in November. In Arkansas, former White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders is heavily favored to be the nominee to replace incumbent Governor Asa Hutchinson, who is term limited. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
KBOO news poet Dan Raphael is very angry and unarmed.
Uvalde, Buffalo, Kenosha, what's with these male teenage killers? The Charleston shooter was 21. Children murdering children. Young Yang gone kablooey. A rare symptom of growing up in an atmosphere of despair and rage. Rage stoked by multiple alleged grown-ups on the internet. Despair stoked by vampire capitalism, lack of opportunity, crumbling environments, 40 in a classroom, and parents suffering from the same. Why are there thousands of banned books but no banned guns? While the unchristian right wants to make sure that babies, even if victims of rape or incest, keep having babies, people not ready to parent, strapped by circumstance and the corrosive chaos of living in a cashocracy. But I'm going to focus on where I have at least the slimmest chance of an impact, like the city planning to turn my neighborhood, that they so sensitively call Lower Southeast, into just another cluster of unaffordable condo blocks and street trees with no chance of survival. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News in Depth, featuring an interview with Street Roots and David Rosenberg on the Ukraine aid package. Then at 6, it's the Underground. Tonight's weather is cloudy, with temperatures dropping to a low of 57 in the early morning. Showers are expected tomorrow afternoon, with temperatures in the 60s. On May 25, 1968, the Gateway Arch in St. Louis, Missouri was officially dedicated. The monument on the west bank of the Mississippi River symbolizes the start of the American West. The quote of the day is from Lyndon B. Johnson. The American West is just arriving at the threshold of its greatness and growth. Where the West of yesterday is glamorized in our fiction, the future of the American West now is both fabulous and factual. After an infection, long-haul COVID can continue to impact the health of its victims. A Utah study seeks to unravel the mystery, and it's looking for volunteers from around the country. Mark Richardson has more on the story.
The National Institutes of Health has begun a nationwide research project to better understand how to prevent and treat what's become known as long COVID, as well as determine who's at risk. The COVID-19 virus has affected millions of Americans, but most people have recuperated from the illness, at least initially. However, doctors say thousands who thought they were done later develop long COVID weeks and even months after the initial symptoms are gone. Long haulers, as they're called, often experience heart and lung problems, fatigue, and cognitive issues like brain fog, says NIH neurologist Dr. Walter Koroshitz, a co-director of the study.
We really don't understand why that is occurring. So the Recover Initiative, which is called Researching COVID to Enhance Recovery, is trying to understand why this is happening, and with that understanding, develop treatments that can help these folks.
The University of Utah is one of more than 80 sites in 30 states that are part of the study. People of all races, genders, ethnicities, ages, and locations are needed to volunteer. Look online at recovercovid.org. One of the study's primary goals, Koroshet says, is to understand why some people get long-haul symptoms and others do not.
The most important group is people who are acutely infected, who had a very recent infection. We want to study how people recover after COVID so we can compare the recovery process of people who do a good job recovering versus those who do a poor job and end up with persistent symptoms.
Koroshet says researchers know the importance of getting a wide variety of people to share their experiences.
The real heroes are the subjects who enroll in this study. The people who are having trouble enroll, I think, because they want to understand what's wrong with them and they want to contribute to the knowledge. We also need people who do it for purely altruistic reasons, the people who are not having trouble.
He adds that volunteers can expect a phone call from a study representative to gather basic demographic information, ask about your experience with COVID-19, and why you want to be part of the study. I'm Mark Richardson for Utah News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
America observes a grim milestone today, 2 years after the murder of George Floyd. Black community leaders in Minneapolis reflect on the work of the racial justice movement and how much change is still needed. Mike Moen has more on the story.
President Joe Biden is using the second anniversary of George Floyd's murder to sign executive orders on police reform. From criminal justice to business opportunities to diversity, black leaders cite a mixed bag in advancing racial equity. After Floyd was murdered by Minneapolis police, solidarity statements and pledges to take action came from a range of institutions. P.J. Hill of the Minneapolis NAACP says there's been progress, but not enough follow-through to help black businesses and smaller nonprofits navigate new investments and grants.
There's so much red tape to go through that, you know, it makes people fatigue, and then the money is just too slow.
A recent milestone is the opening of Minnesota's first ever black-owned bank, but national research shows a long road ahead in reducing economic disparities. The Brookings Institution pegs the U.S. racial wealth gap at $10 trillion. Meanwhile, Biden's action is getting praise from civil rights groups, but they note the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act still awaits final approval in Congress. Hill encourages allies in the white community to keep looking inward, to reflect on their own unconscious bias and spark conversations within their networks. He says that urgency can't be allowed to dissipate in the days after a tragedy.
What about after the news cycle? Continue to make that investment, continue to have that same fire, which is tough for us all to do, but I think it's going to take a concerted effort on all of our parts to really make the change that we would like to see.
In the Fargo-Moorhead area, Connie Odnis's immigrant communities through the Afro-American Development Association. He says the region expressed a supportive tone after Floyd's death, but he notes hate crimes still cloud the issue, and a lack of diversity in local institutions is glaring.
For example, the city that I live now, when you see the employees, it's not totally diverse. I want to see diverse people working together.
Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection. Find our rate trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
1 year ago, the remains of over 200 Indigenous children were discovered at the site of a Canadian residential school in British Columbia. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau shared statements at a memorial ceremony in Kamloops. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. It's been almost exactly 1 year since the remains of possibly more than 200 children were found at a site of a former residential school in British Columbia. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau attended a memorial gathering in Kamloops, B.C.
Trudeau says the unmarked burial ground set off a reckoning for Canadians about the country's history and relations with Indigenous people.
I hear you. This is about remembering those we lost. This is about gathering and reflecting on where we are and mostly where we need to go all together.
It's been a year since the unmarked graves of 215 children were found at the former school site. Trudeau added that this was a difficult year for survivors and their families, and there is a long road ahead for reconciliation. Governor General Mary Simon also attended the gathering. She said what was known by most Indigenous people, the suffering and loss caused by the residential schools, is now known by all.
But you haven't yet had time to grieve, to make peace in your hearts. I hope today contributes to that process of healing.
Simon says the remains found have been called a discovery, but for survivors of the Indian residential schools, it's a confirmation. Simon is the first Indigenous person in Canada to hold the office of Governor General. The chief of the Tecumloops to Sequetmoc First Nation, Roseanne Casimir, says she's disappointed that the Pope will not visit Kamloops when he comes to Canada next month, although she's still pleased that he will meet with other Indigenous people in Canada. Last month, Pope Francis apologized for the Catholic Church's role in running the residential schools. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Lower Brule Sioux Tribe has filed a lawsuit against a South Dakota county for delaying a redistricting plan that would ensure the election of Native candidates to the county commission. The lawsuit alleges the delay prevents Lower Brule from electing two commissioners in the upcoming election. Victoria Wicks has more.
Lyman County has had an at-large election process since 1992. That means candidates running for the five commissioner seats can live anywhere within the county. Lyman County contains part of the Lower Brule Reservation and has a Native population of 38%. With at-large elections, no Native candidate has ever succeeded in winning a seat on the county commission. To avoid a lawsuit, Lyman County and Lower Brule agreed that the county must establish two commissioner positions chosen by Native voters. In October 2021, Lower Brule proposed five single-candidate districts, two of them Native majority and three white majority. According to plaintiffs, that scheme was legal under existing South Dakota law. But in February, the Lyman County Commission enacted an ordinance establishing just two voting districts, one white with three commissioners and one Native with two commissioners. And the commission voted to delay the changes until after the next election. Lyman County then went to the state legislature and asked for a change in state law to allow the two-district plan. When the State Senate Affairs Committee took up the bill on March 2nd, Lower Brule Tribal Vice Chairman Cody Russell testified against that change.
Because county commissioner races are staggered, Native voters will not have the chance to elect the two representatives that we should have until 2026.
Russell said Native voters would be denied full rights for 4 years, and he said that Lyman County's plan defeats the intent of the Voting Rights Act.
This plan divides the county into Native and white districts, segregating us and deepening existing tensions.
Russell is one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. They are asking the federal court to stop the delay and allow the election this year of two Native commissioners. I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Gustavo Petro is a former Marxist revolutionary fighter. Now he's running for Colombia's highest office. In a country long known for right-wing governments and civil war, leftist candidates are receiving a wave of support in the polls. Since his guerrilla group, M19, made peace with the Colombian government in the 1990s, Petro has earned popularity as the mayor of the country's capital city, Bogota. Petro is no stranger to the campaign trail. In fact, he's run for president twice before. However, polling projections cast him as a frontrunner for the first time this year. Petro is campaigning on a platform of peace talks with militias and drug cartels, trade protections meant to protect Colombian farmers, and, in a break from leftist policies in neighboring Venezuela, phasing out oil exploration. Colombia's economy relies heavily on oil exports, but the country has been hit by environmental damage and the effects of climate change. Trailing in second is Petro's main opponent, Federico Gutierrez, the center-right former mayor of Colombia's second-largest city. With poverty at its highest levels in the country in decades, violence and income inequality are key issues for most voters. Campaigners have been speaking behind bulletproof shields at rallies due to the ongoing threat of political violence. Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, said today that Russia must pull back to its pre-war positions before diplomatic talks can occur. Speaking by video link at this year's World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, President Zelensky appeared willing to negotiate with Russian President Vladimir Putin directly. He stressed that Moscow also needs to be ready to, quote, shift from the bloody war to diplomacy, end quote. Zelensky clarified that he would negotiate if Russian troops withdrew to their February 24th positions. That means renouncing their gains in southern Ukraine in the Donbas, but remaining in Russian annexed Crimea. February 24th was the day the Russian invasion began. Zelensky also made clear that Ukraine wants Russian troops out of all captured areas. He said Ukraine would fight until it claimed all of its territories, aiming for independence and its sovereignty. Ukraine's Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba called for friendly countries, particularly the United States, to provide the Ukrainian military with multiple launch rocket systems so they could try to recapture territory. Kuleba said, quote, Every day of someone sitting in Washington, Berlin, Paris, and other capitals, and considering whether they should or should not do something, costs us lives and territories." End quote. While Ukraine calls for negotiations, Moscow recently signaled it is trying to bolster its stretched military apparatus in Ukraine. Russian lawmakers passed a bill which eliminates the age limit of 40 for those signing their first voluntary military contracts. The measure is allegedly aimed at hiring people with so-called in-demand specialisms. A description of the bill on the parliament website indicated older recruits might be suited to operate precision weapons or to serve in engineering or medical roles. Russian authorities have said that only volunteer contract soldiers are sent to fight in Ukraine, although they have acknowledged earlier that some draftees were drawn into the fighting by accident. Separately, President Putin just issued an order to allow a fast track to Russian citizenship for people in two southern regions of Ukraine, which are largely held by Russian forces. Russia already has a program for fast-track naturalization of people living in two regions of eastern Ukraine, claimed by Russia-backed separatists. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 25th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our producers today are Ethan Sandweiss, Dan Raphael, and myself, Josh Salem, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Nadia Ramlagan, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Roz Brown, and Mark Richardson. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for the News in Depth.